You're listening to Let's Talk Business, the business podcast with me, Susan Smith, for Ross FM and for Anchor FM, coming to you every week with interesting interviews from entrepreneurs all over the world. Today, fortunately for us, on the line, we have David. David, how are you doing?
I am very well. I'm enjoying the sunshine, Susan.
That's great. And you know, remarkably, we actually have a bit of sunshine here today, which is quite unusual for Ireland.
I've been to Ireland. The sun does shine.
It's very rarely. You must have brought it with you when you came.
It's one of my skills.
Well, David, I just have a few questions here for you. You've had a very interesting business career. And amazingly, at the beginning of your bio, you said it's not a typical entrepreneurial start that you had. But from reading your bio, it sounds like you're every inch the entrepreneur from all of the different highs and lows and ups and downs you've had throughout your career. But David, you had a very interesting start in life, being born to teenage parents and starting a business and ultimately a great cause, breeding beetles. Can you talk to us a little bit about those early days?
Those two early days. Yeah, my parents were very young, and so they had to learn how to be parents by having children. They were in their late teens in the early 1960s in London. My father was a very junior police cadet, and my mother was attempting to do her A-levels, and along I came. But they did a pretty good job. So we started off in tiny little police flats, which, as you can imagine, are rather sort of crowded and rather like apartment living. And then slowly my parents moved out towards leafy Surrey step by step. And they always did a very good job of finding me a school. So that's paid dividends all the way through my life. I've been extremely grateful to them for that. So the big jump then is from school through to university. And that thing that happens to a lot of people at the end of their university degree, they look around and think, well, what do I do now? And I was phoned up, actually, by a very, very interesting man, a man called Guillaume Perrier, who was a French academic who had this wild idea that he could stop a terrible tree disease spreading across Europe. And he literally phoned me, and I was sat there in my shorts in my student flat thinking, excellent, I'll pack up and go home. And he said, come and work in France for the rest of your life. So so I did. And so I packed everything up in a cardboard suitcase and I went off and lived in a tiny town. If you can find it on a map, you get a prize, called Bougeat in the middle of Limousin in France. I spoke no French, none at all, despite my school's best efforts. So I had to learn French or starve to death. And I ran a group of Turkish foresters with chainsaws. And what we did was we found this really wonderful beetle called Rhizophagus grandis. Wonderful. Doesn't matter. We found this wonderful beetle that eats other beetles. And we bred our really aggressive beetle and we let it loose in the forest and it ate all the bad beetles. And that's why you still have spruce trees. Otherwise, you wouldn't.
Wow, that's actually extremely interesting.
It was really great fun. I mean, it was really, really good fun driving around France in a terrible little car, trying to work out how to make this pay, because it was just, it was crazy, because nobody would pay, because they think trees just grow. By the way, trees do not just grow, people. Trees need help. But I learned so much. Guy was amazing. And I did a master's in French, so I learned enough French to do something in France. And then women. And then I decided that the woman I loved lived in England, so I came home.
Oh, so was that the end to your beetle career then?
That was a sad end to my beetle career. I had a degree in forestry, which is slightly relevant. And the wonder of it was it taught me an awful lot about very long-term thinking. And I guess I'm always going to be grateful to my college and the university for making me think about the long term.
Yes, of course.
And how everything complicated joins together to make a business work. And so it was the end of my career. I got fed up with being rained on. Really? Seriously? You know, you get wet a lot if you're in the forest trade. So I came back and became an accountant, where I got less wet, but it was actually quite a lot less fun most of the time.
I'd well believe it. David, in 2000, you jumped into the world of entrepreneurship. Was that an absolute shock to the system after spending so long working in accounts?
Oh, boy. I came from the biggest, well, fastest growing, not quite the biggest, the biggest accountancy firm in the world. And I was up against the become a partner or leave decision, which happens to a lot of people. And some friends of mine that I played, this is going to sound like a terrible nerd, but I'm going to confess on radio here, as it were. So I was a paper and pencil role player. So I played role playing games.
Wow.
And some friends that I played these games with said, hey, we've got this really great idea for a computer game. And I was either too nice or too stupid or too optimistic. And anyway, I decided it was a really good idea. So I hope Ian Livingstone at IDOS will forgive me for this. We sat in his office and we negotiated. And the negotiations were tough, really, really tough. And my friends had said, could you do the numbers for us? You're an accountant. Can you do the numbers? Oh, every time I hear that, my heart sinks. But I came out realizing I could negotiate. Instead of the terms of the deal or whatever they say in their accounts back in 1999, 2000. And my memory is not good enough to remember precisely. What I do remember is coming out really with an entire team, a pile of money, some intellectual property, and realizing I was now chief executive of a computer games company.
Wow.
Almost by accident. And I said to Deloitte, you know what? I enjoyed this entrepreneur thing much more. I'd built businesses inside Deloitte, by the way. I mean, it wasn't like complete shock to the system.
Okay.
I'd built a forensic computing team. I'd built others. So I'd done some intrapreneuring.
Okay.
But it's kind of baby stuff. You know, you're wrapped up in 10,000 geniuses, all of whom are there to help you. And, you know, credit to the big firms. They really do know what they're doing. They are very, very good. And so anyway, I stepped out with four friends and 21 staff and some of the greatest names in computer games on our board. And we worked really hard for 2.5 years and delivered a game called Warrior Kings, which you can still buy on Steam. Please don't, because we don't get any royalties. They go to somebody who basically picked it up after we went bust. Oh, that was awful.
Well, actually,
that
David,
was awful.
I was just going to ask you about that. This particular company folded within the first 5 years, as many new startups do. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, that was horrible. Really, really horrible. We'd got a number one game. It had just gone to number one in the budget charts. And we ran out of cash because we had a major customer who went bust in France, a company called Microids. And we were devastated. There was about £3.7 million of royalties owed to us on the sales of this game. And no way of recovering them. This company in France had been terribly badly managed and run. And it collapsed, taking all of our sort of revenue and profits with it. An absolutely devastating blow.
Wow.
I was heartbroken. I sold the residue of the company to an entrepreneur who didn't do a brilliant job with it, but kept it going for a little while. And I had to really search my soul. Who is important? Who do you look after? The shareholders, the staff, the customers? What do you do when the business just disappears under your feet almost overnight, within 2 months?
Gosh.
The whole thing just folds up. What do you do? And it's the most painful, brutal, scorching experience that an entrepreneur can have. And I wasn't fit to run another business for a couple of years after that. I really wasn't in any mental or physical state to do so. It's devastating. There's no getting around that.
So it absolutely had a profound effect on you, David. And just to ask, the capital that you had raised initially, did you at least cover that, or had you paid that back and were in profit?
No, we hadn't, unfortunately. The shareholders did take a loss, although they did receive some return. The shareholders took a loss. Interestingly, five or six of those shareholders have followed me in almost every business I've ever done.
Okay.
So despite that, I learned something really, really important. And because I wasn't quick enough to tell them what was going on, when it did collapse, it was a surprise. And I was, it was explained to me. There was some swearing involved.
But
had I been a better CEO and spoken to them more clearly faster, they would have helped me more. And never to be afraid of telling the truth to your stakeholders. And that lesson was, that's like kind of lesson number one for young entrepreneurs. Tell the truth, tell it fast, expect help. And if you don't get it, then you have to go and find it.
Okay.
Your shareholders are actually there to help you. Amazingly,
this is true.
They're not like a bank. They're real humans, and they invested in you for a reason. That reason doesn't change because times are bad.
True.
I learned some really, really harsh lessons. Some of those people then followed me in every business I've ever done. So some, of course, will possibly never speak to me ever again.
Well, we do get losses in life, unfortunately.
Yeah, but we do. And you have to live with them. You do.
And you have to accept them. And you really have to move on, because you can never, ever give up, really. In your second startup, that was the first of many lessons for you, David. In your second startup, you learned about, and I've experienced in this myself, being an entrepreneur and dealing with China regularly, cross-cultural dealings and outsourcing. I'm absolutely dying to hear what you have to say about this.
And I'm absolutely dying not to get sued by anybody.
We'll be very careful. I'll edit out names.
You'll be fine. What did I learn? I went to work in India. Is this the one you're particularly thinking of?
Yes.
Going to work in India?
Yes.
Yeah, so I went to work in India, set up a little game studio for a really, really lovely Sikh entrepreneur out there. Great people. But I learned something from that, and what I took away was there's a distinct difference between cheap and good.
Yes, very true.
The cross-cultural dealings were twofold. The first of which is, what works in one culture creatively absolutely does not work in another. So trying to sell things based on Indian mythology just doesn't fly in India. It doesn't fly outside of certain parts of India, let alone anywhere else in the world. And a tiny example, when you're trying to make a computer game that involves doors, Indian doors don't look the same as European or American doors. And it's that simple thing confused people trying to play the game. The doors were wrong.
The doors?
So, yeah, tiny little doors. Yeah, doors, heavily decorated Indian doors versus plain with a handle on European and American doors. Really interesting. So learned something. But I also learned that quality of management really matters. This is back in the mid-2000s. You could buy in those days teams of quite talented programmers and artists for approximately 20% of what they would cost in Europe. Nowadays, it's closer to 60, 70%. But we found the error rate, reject rate, and the cost of managing those teams greatly outweighed any benefit we could obtain from using teams in the subcontinent. And that's not because they're better or worse. They're a long way away. Their management style, work ethic, quality standards at that point in time were nowhere close to Europe. So all the savings and benefits we thought we would get were eaten up in dealing with the problems.
Yes.
Which was a real shame. But so I've taken away from that, if you're going to outsource, you have to make your outsource partner responsible for the quality without exception.
Yes, fully agree.
And do not waste your own time on trying to make them better. You can't.
I've been there.
You can't. It's a lifetime job. So yes. Well, there we go. We'll have a quiet smile and a chai latte over that one. It's really hard. It's great for call centers. It's fantastic. You know, if you want thousands of call center operators, knock yourself out. If you want to deliver a creative technological product, perhaps look closer to home.
Yes, I agree.
Maybe I should outsource to Ireland more.
Well, you should. Yes, we'll have a chat about that afterwards. David, you seem to be a genius when it comes to raising capital. How have you so successfully managed to raise capital for all of your startups?
I recently measured my IQ and I'm absolutely average, Susan. So thank you for the flattery, but I'm afraid the facts are against you. The facts are absolutely against you. I've learned from that first lesson. I carried on telling the truth.
Okay.
And I was very careful only to approach first of all, not to raise capital for businesses that won't work. Don't. Okay,
yes.
Just don't. And so I have a very, very sort of technical, I guess, assessment of what is ready for investment. And it's a thing I do now. In fact, I was doing it earlier this week for a local authority, talking to startups in large groups about, do not raise money until you are ready. And here's how you know you're ready. And there's a list. And I could bore you with it, but except there's a list, 12 points. Unless those things are true, don't raise money. So I learned not to raise money for things that could not pay the investor back.
Okay.
Second thing, be passionate and only raise money for things you personally care about. That really matters. So I've raised about £18 million for other people, as well as money for my own startups. The other thing is only offer the investment to an investor who meets a second list of roughly 12 points. And those are people that have the funding to hand, who like the sector, who are passionate about this sort of thing, whatever that sort of thing is, who have the time to look at a new offer, and where there is some kind of warm connectivity. It doesn't have to be very warm, but my general rule is, unless I've bought you a pint or had a pint with you, I probably don't know you well enough to pitch to you.
Okay.
I'll settle for a coffee in your offices, but I won't pitch to you until I've met you.
Okay.
There we go. So that's
points.
Really, it's not horribly complicated.
Mm.
It's not horribly complicated. It's kind of a human thing. I can summarize all fundraising. It is a sales job.
Yes, absolutely.
It's about selling.
Absolutely.
It's about selling. So the best fundraisers are people who can sell.
Indeed.
There we go.
David, you subsequently went on to start two more businesses before enlisting in a life coach. Do you think that coaching has had a dramatic effect or a difference in your career and how you deal with situations?
Oh, absolutely. I've been, I wouldn't describe, it's interesting. Other people describe the people I work with as coaches. I've been really blessed with, and I'm so grateful for the people who've taken me under their wing. I'm probably won't name them to save their embarrassment and knowing how precious their time is. But there's a very, very well-known entrepreneur in Cambridge, in his 70s, multiple listed companies, who has always been there for me to do one of two things. Simply say, yes, keep doing that, or say, you probably ought to stop doing that. And you can't put a price on that kind of advice. Although, you know, that's the results of 3 or 4 hours of pouring my heart onto his coffee table and him pouring coffee into the cup. And then, you know, I would try and return the favor, but I would say it's very much a one-way transaction. There are two others. There's a merchant banker who I walk with, and I found that walking side by side with somebody is the best way to tell the truth. Somehow not looking somebody in the eye makes you more willing to say something that's painful. So I can use his first name. I think I'll get away with that. So, James, thank you very much for all the long walks and the bottles of wine. But he's a very experienced investor, very well respected in the political world. And he has always, always been there to help me with that crossover of work, life and business. And a third person who I've only known recently, who's a professional in this space, Jonathan, again, thanks, who has extended immense knowledge and wisdom in short, pithy sentences, usually by text, some of which I definitely can't read out on live radio, but others are, you know, just brilliant. Absolutely. A guy that can cut to the heart of it. Sadly, no female founders or mentors in my world. And I think that's a really serious missing point, A, in my life, but also in the world in general, that female mentors are rare, really rare.
They're rare, but
anyway.
What's rare is wonderful.
There we go.
David,
so, yeah, I would say it's definitely changed my life.
Well, that's actually fantastic.
Do it. If you have a chance, do it.
We're just coming up to our final question now. Can you talk us through what it is you are doing now? Come to 2018 and you've made a sharp turn into triple impact investing, social impact work, community volunteering and business mentoring. What is it you are actually doing right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. One my wife asks me very often, what on earth are you doing with your life? So what I do is I get paid 3 days a week for doing serious business analysis, advice, strategy, lead generation, team building, that sort of thing. So I get paid for doing that.
Okay.
I work for some family offices. I work for some businesses, and I work for... nice people. Actually, I have a really simple view. I'll only work for you if you're nice people, because I don't need to work for bad people, so I won't. Why should I help them? And triple impact is this. I won't work, and I know it sounds awful, but I think if more people did this, it would be incredibly powerful. I won't work for a business unless it has three objectives. Make money. If you don't make money, you're not sustainable. You won't be here next year. So it's just a charity. It's just a dream. Okay. Second thing is you must do good for society. And I mean that in the broadest sense. So diversity by gender, diversity by race, diversity by background. I want to see companies that employ on a diverse basis that give back to their local community as well as their national community as well as to the world. So employing young people, giving head starts, doing internal training. People invest in people,
yes,
and their communities, and they have to do good for the planet. Because I have kids, and I'm hoping one day there'll be a little sort of line of the family stretching into the distance, and I would like the planet to still be here. I'm a biologist, yes, and I can see the kind of terrible mess we've made of our planet right now. I'd like to see every company do better. And you know what's really odd? It's a rhetorical question. What's really odd is if you do those three things, you make more money. So yes, why isn't everybody doing it?
Exactly.
If you're socially diverse, integrated, community positive, and environmentally positive, you tend to waste less, be better, make better decisions, and make more profits. It's kind of a win-win-win situation.
Absolutely.
So if I find people like that, I want to help them. But I just haven't got time to convince people who haven't already understood it to do it. So if they're listening to this podcast, off you go, read the research, and then come back and employ me. That'd be great.
Excellent. Absolutely. Excellent, David. Well, on a final note, if you could give one small piece of advice to any entrepreneur who's starting off, what would it be?
Oh, that is an absolutely killer question because there's so much embedded in that. Okay, so Susan, here it goes. Do it, but not at risk of your own mental or physical health.
Excellent.
So do it, but set a very clear line that says, if I run my financial safety net down to this point, I will stop. Do it, but if you find that you're sleeping under, let's say, 6 hours a night, so some sensible amount of sleep for you, and you start gaining weight or losing weight dramatically, or you start getting sick more often, please stop. No amount of entrepreneurial success is worth making yourself unwell. And all these hero stories of entrepreneurs who sleep 4 hours on the carpet and,
yes,
you know, battle through, don't, because that isn't you. Okay, and it will probably make you really sick and you'll probably fail, which is sad. So by all means, be an entrepreneur, but please don't hurt yourself whilst doing it, because frankly, there's lots of jobs. There are lots of entrepreneurs. The world doesn't particularly need more entrepreneurs, but what it needs is good, healthy, happy, cheerful, good entrepreneurs. Do that. If that's you, thumbs up, double thumbs up. Love to help.
Incredible stuff, David. I have to say, in all of the interviews that I've done over the past few years, that's possibly the best piece of advice I have heard yet to any entrepreneur who is starting off. And it's very, very seldom that you hear somebody give that kind of advice to budding entrepreneurs, because you do hear the hero stories of, I only sleep 3 hours a night and this, that and the other. But it's mental and physical health is extremely important. David, we're just at the end of our interview, and I just want to say thank you so much for speaking with us here on the Business Podcast today.
Susan, can I just say thank you for the opportunity? It's an absolute delight when people ask questions that get to the heart of what really matters. And please keep on doing it with other entrepreneurs. I shall listen intently.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, David.